I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to re-examine the Great Depression from the perspective of people living in a small Indiana community. Retired Wall Street Journal editor and columnist George Malone has written a new book that will be published in a few days. It's called When the New Deal Came to Town, a snapshot of a place and time with lessons for today. That place is Whiteland, Indiana, where Malone grew up. We'll talk with him about the book, the Hoosier community that inspired it, and his career. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today with George Malone. He is a retired Wall Street Journal editor and columnist. And the occasion for our conversation today is he's also the author of a book that will be published in just a few days, next Tuesday to be precise, called When the New Deal Came to Town, A Snapshot of a Place and Time with Lessons for Today. It's a memoir of him growing up in the New Deal years in Whiteland, Indiana. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, George Malone, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, John.
It's good to have you here. So talk to me a little bit about how you got there. There's so many places I want to carry this conversation, but I think we need to start with the book. How did you arrive at the idea? Because and I've read it. And I enjoyed the book a great deal. It is an interesting approach because it is, in some ways, an economic and historic exploration with the sweetener of autobiography thrown into it. So there's some weight to it. There's some gravitas.
Yeah, it was a bit experimental. I have always wanted to do a memoir about Whiteland, and because I had a nice childhood there, and I always had a certain affection for that little village. It was a different place at that time. It was a country village, a farm village. And all of us who grew up there just seemed to love our childhood, even though we were right in the depths of the Depression. So I always wanted to get back to that in a memoir, but I also wanted to do a political economic examination of the causes of the Depression. That subject has fascinated me, as it has many people. So I thought, well, it'll be an experiment, but I'll try to combine the two. And that's how the book came out.
Which part was harder to deal with? I mean, the treatise part of it or the memoir part of it?
Actually, I've been writing about economics all my life, so that wasn't all that hard. I mean, you know, I wrote editorials for the Wall Street Journal for many years. And the memories, you know, came back. I asked one of my classmates who has lived in Whiteland all her life to refresh me on names and things that both of us remembered, but she remembered better than I did, so I had some help on that. So it worked out okay, I think.
In terms of conjuring up those memories, because, you know, the 1930s are at least the first half of them are more than 80 years ago, how did you go about recreating what that atmosphere is like? Because in my own mind, if I go back to places that are significant in my life, I can find that difficulty of recalling, peeling away the layers of all the changes from that time a hard thing. And one of the things that I think is remarkable about the book is that I do get a sense as I'm reading it, okay, I am in Whiteland, Indiana. It is the 1930s. I can see this stuff unfolding.
Well, I'm glad you do get that sense. I don't know. You find as you get older that the memories of the early years sort of come flooding back. And so I retain quite a few memories of those years. And as I say, my friend Carolyn Wendt has the same ability to recall things that happened back then. And it's really rather delightful to be able to write about write those memories. And so it was kind of a fun book to write.
What made it delightful? I mean, when you say, because it's clear you did enjoy it.
Yeah. I often wonder that. It was, we were kind of free spirits. We were in a little country village. Where you knew everybody, and you could get on your bicycle and ride out into the country in a very short space of time. That was a little later as I grew older, but I came from a big family, and I don't know, it was just something that it was just. Carolyn, both Carolyn and I think we had a very happy childhood.
How did you go about weaving in the economic analysis, the political analysis of what was going on at that time?
Well, that's what I do in the book. Mm-hmm. I go back to... In some ways, the farmers were their own worst enemies, as it turned out. They didn't know that at the time. But they had a very strong lobby. You know, 48% of the country, the population of the country, which was only over something over 100 million people at that point, less than one-third of what it is now, were living in rural places like Whiteland, mm-hmm. or on farms or small towns like Franklin or Greenwood or whatever. So half the country was populated by people who lived in rural settings. So they had a lot of political influence. The farm lobby was very powerful back then. And they lobbied... beginning in the beginning of the 20th century, they started lobbying for various government supports, and the upshot came when after the crash, which should have been just a normal crash. I mean, we have had crashes before and since, but none quite worked out the way that one did. After the crash, the farmers started lobbying for import protection. And then business and labor decided, well, they needed some protection too. So you ended up with the Smoot-Hawley bill, mm-hmm. which covered 20,000 dutiable items. It's a huge amount of items. And they doubled the tariffs up to from 25%, which was very high, from an average of 25%, which was very high, up to 50%. And that basically just shut down world trade, and the farmers suffered enormously from that. They lost about $1 billion worth of trade between 1930 and 1933. So that was a big mistake. About 1,000 economists sent a petition to Herbert Hoover saying, don't sign this bill, some of the best economists in the country. But he was under a lot of political pressure, and he signed it. So it was very costly for him and the country.
Yeah, it's and I'm probably oversimplifying. I don't think I'm giving anything away in the book, because you pretty much offer this up in the introduction.
Mm-hmm.
Part of your thesis to the degree the book has a thesis, because it is a memoir, too. It's a recounting of a time and place, is that the stock market crash was a bad situation, but not an unprecedented one.
Absolutely.
At that point. That government action then took and made worse. It took a bad situation and turned it into a catastrophe. What were some of the steps? And even though New Deal is in the title, as you just pointed out, there are references to Hoover, too, and his presidency as well. What were some of the steps they did to deepen what were the difficulties then?
Well, first Hoover with Smoot-Hawley. And then also Hoover and the Republicans raised taxes. Now, these taxes at that time were only on high-income earners, but that was right after the crash, and the high-income people are the people who invest, so that was not a particularly good move. And then FDR came along, and FDR, during the 1932 campaign, sounded pretty good. He wanted to repeal Smoot-Hawley. But then his first 100 days were just a long string of government interventions in the economy, some very drastic interventions, including the National Industrial Recovery Act. And that was very damaging. It was almost fascism. And it destroyed the confidence of business. The confidence had already been damaged a great deal, and that certainly didn't help. Fortunately, that was repealed in knocked down by the Supreme Court in 1935, and nobody made any effort to revive it because it was such a terrible bill. So those kinds of things came along, and that's how we kind of prolonged the. What should have been a normal recession.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with author and retired Wall Street Journal editor and columnist George Malone about his new book, When the New Deal Came to Town. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can reach out to us on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Terry has done. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Terry's got a question that speaks more to the memoir part of this. George, could you talk about the origin of the name Whiteland for the town? Is it because of any inherent racism, or is it?
Nothing at all like that. They actually gave the town the name. It started with a little general store, and then a grist mill, and then a wagon shop, right alongside the railroad track, what is now the Pennsylvania Railroad. And they called it Wheatland at first, and then somebody said, "Hey, wait a minute, there's another Wheatland in Indiana." And there was somebody in town named White, so they decided, well, Whiteland. That goes back to about 1849, somewhere back there.
So how much of the research on the because your family didn't arrive there until, what, the 1920s, if I recall reading the book correctly, right?
They came to Indiana in 1918 from Louisville, Kentucky.
Okay, did they arrive? But originally they were in Greenwood, right?
Yeah.
Part of Greenwood, if I recall on the text, right? Demonstrating here I actually have read the book. in terms of discovering all of this or relating it, you probably had to do some research because some of the stuff you make reference to occurred before you were born.
Well, absolutely. And I did a lot of research in the Greenwood Public Library. I did at the Johnson County Historical Society. And, I did a lot of research.
So let me ask this. In terms of, recreating that time and period, are there people in the community, besides me, I guess, who have read the book already? Read your book?
Yeah.
What I'm trying to get at is one of the things that struck me is, all of these surnames I recognize because the families are still there. What's the response been?
Well, actually, not very many people have read the book yet because it won't be published till next Tuesday
and, on Election Day.
A few people have seen the pre-pub copies, but it'll be interesting to find out or hear from people who recognize their own family names in that book. And so that's to come yet. I don't know much about that yet.
We are talking with retired Wall Street Journal editor and columnist George Malone about his new book, When the New Deal Came to Town, A Snapshot of a Place and Time with Lessons for Today. It's about Whiteland, which is just down the road from us. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881 or send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today with author George Malone. He's a retired Wall Street Journal editor and columnist, as well as a native Hoosier. His new book is When the New Deal Came to Town, A Snapshot of a Place and Time with Lessons for Today. That place is Whiteland, Indiana, which is about, I would guess, 15 miles south of Indianapolis in Johnson County. We're talking about how it is an interesting approach in that it mixes political and economic analysis with the memoir recollection of your time growing up. I got to ask, because the recollections are pretty detailed here, and the connections from, you know, what you're doing, riding your bicycle and you know, stopping at a railroad track and all of that flows seamlessly then toward examining what the foreign policy was
right
at that time. Were you as attuned to political events at that young age? Because in the 1930s, by the time 1940 rolled around, you were, what, 12, 13 years old, something like that, if I did my math correctly in there.
Yeah.
Were you as attuned to political events when you were a child and aware, or is that something that came later?
Well, I think I probably was. I think at about the age of 12, I decided I wanted to be a writer. Mm-hmm. So, and I didn't really... I kind of thought maybe fiction, but journalism certainly interested me. So, yes, I think I was pretty much attuned, particularly to the things that were going on in Europe. I mean, mm-hmm. you could hardly ignore what was happening in Europe. But certainly, I would hang out down at the barber shop and listening, the loafers, as they called themselves, at the barber shop, watching haircuts and debating various issues, and I love to hear those arguments being made. So I became a professional debater, or what you might say, an editorial writer, raising arguments and conducting a forum for people to discuss public events. So that was kind of a natural transition from the barbershop at Whiteland, Indiana.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with George Malone. He is retired Wall Street Journal editor and columnist. We're talking with him about his new book, When the New Deal Came to Town. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Todd has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Todd, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, more of a comment. I guess a question. I was wondering if George gets any comparisons to his voice to a certain broadcaster.
I got the note, so I know which broadcaster you're making reference to.
Yeah, I didn't want to reference it because I wanted to see if you'd say it first.
Well, I listened to all those guys, and that's my business. I'm in the journalism business, the media business, But I haven't. I don't listen to Rush all that often, really. And he's kind of entertaining when I do listen to him. But I have other things that I do.
Yeah. So which one do you think he sounds like, Todd?
Is that the one you're talking about?
I tuned in a little bit late, so I didn't hear the introduction. I could have swore you were talking to Tom Brokaw.
Oh, okay.
Oh, well,
you thought
thank
the
you.
Voice. The voice, yeah.
I admire his voice, certainly.
Yeah, and you probably take his book sales, too.
Yeah, right? Certainly.
Well, thanks very much for the call, Todd. I appreciate
it.
Thanks. Certainly. So you said you wanted to be a writer starting at age 12. What was it that appealed to you at that age?
Well,
I
was a reader. I like to read. And, I read a whole book of Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain. And I thought, I'd really like to do this kind of thing. I'd like to be published. And it worked out somehow.
So it's a long path. From Whiteland, Indiana, in the heart of the Great Depression, to writing for the Wall Street Journal, one of the two or three most powerful, influential newspapers, not just in this country, but in the world. Can you walk me through the steps that led you there? And, in some ways, talking about your career as editor and columnist reduces it in ways that are unfortunate, because there, long before you became an editor and a columnist, you were doing interesting things in interesting places. So could you talk with me a little bit about how you made that transition from Whiteland, Indiana, to the Wall Street Journal?
Well, it required a lot of luck and just being in the right place at the right time. I started out with the Greenwood News. There was a fellow, the editor of the Greenwood News, the editor and owner of the Greenwood News back in the 1930s, was a fellow named Chick Harris, 1930s, 40s, and 50s. And then it was absorbed by the Daily Journal. I learned a lot about journalism there, but I also went to Butler University and took journalism after I got out of the Army. And so I was well on my way, and I worked at Logansport and Muncie, Indiana, on papers. And finally, with the help of my journalism professor at Butler, I landed a job on the Chicago edition of the Wall Street Journal. And the rest was history. I just kept plugging away and trying to, not make too many mistakes, those kinds of things. And I just evolved from reporter to bureau manager to page one editor to foreign correspondent. And then I came back and joined the editorial page. After I joined, about 3 years later, I became deputy editor of the page. And sometime later, I started a column and so forth. So, wonderful career. I just got very lucky.
What years were you a foreign correspondent? That's a very romantic job now, and sadly there are fewer of them than there were at one time.
Yeah, it was a great time. I was I went to London in 1966, and I covered some big stories. I covered the Six-Day War, which was that was a real trial to go into a place that's being covered by everybody. Mm-hmm. And the big problem is just filing, getting the message out. Now you pick up your cell phone, you can file. But back then you had to use a cable system of some sort. And I covered the Biafran War. I went over to the Soviet Union and wrote about their attempts to reform their economy, which never worked out, really. And I covered the strikes in France in 1968. And I just had a lot of fun. I mean, it was a great assignment. But I didn't want to be a permanent expatriate. So I always wanted to be an editorial writer. So I asked the editor of the editorial page to if he could give me a job. And he brought me back. And so I joined the page.
How long were you overseas as a foreign correspondent?
About 4 years.
4 years, and all of it in London, or was it?
I was operating out of London, but I was traveling all over the Middle East, Africa, Europe, and all kinds of places. So it was, but I was based in London.
What did you like most about that work in those years?
Just the excitement of it, going to places you'd never been before, strange places like the Soviet Union, trying to analyze economies that were very different from ours, like the Soviet economy or the Israeli economy. The Israeli's economy was heavily socialist at that time. The Spanish system was under Franco. And there were a lot of interesting things to write about people who were trying to get out from under Franco's thumb and so forth. So it was just extremely interesting work, not only traveling to interesting places, but trying to figure out what was going on in those places and writing about it.
What did you like least about that? I mean, it's one of those jobs that sounds really, really glamorous.
Well, the pressure could be very intense, as I mentioned. If you're covering a big story and you're in a place where there's, you not only have to write the story. We used to say writing the story was about half the work. Getting it out to your publisher was the other half. You had to get access to a teletype or a cable office, very hectic, and you are under constant fear that you won't get the story out and everybody else will. You're competing with all those people, and so it gets stressful, as you might say.
You got to go to the Soviet Union at a time when not a lot of Americans were able to make that journey. Did you ever kind of pinch yourself and say, what's a farm kid from Whiteland, Indiana, doing here?
Exactly. I remember I was down in Tashkent, which it's part of Uzbekistan, and it was part of the Soviet Union back in those days, and I was in a hotel room, and it suddenly dawned on me, what's a kid from Indiana doing in a place like this? I had that feeling many times.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with retired Wall Street editor, columnist, foreign correspondent George Malone on the occasion of the publication of his new book, When the New Deal Came to Town, A Snapshot of a Place in Time with Lessons for Today. The place he's talking about in that book is Whiteland, Indiana. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what David has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Mr. Malone, I own a farm in north of Indianapolis, and I grew up in Muncie, Indiana, and my father was a radio and television news broadcaster, and we also had a good friend there, Dwight Hoover, who grew up during the Depression. He was a history professor at Ball State, retired, and he went on to teach in Japan and Eastern Europe. But at any rate, he wrote a book about growing up during the Depression in Iowa, and my question is, in that book, he relates that farmers, he would take their livestock to the Chicago stockyards to survive the Depression, and he went with his father. And my question was about in Indiana. Was there similar activity in the farm, in farms in Indiana?
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks very much for the call, David.
Farms were very diversified back then, much more so than today. Here in Indiana, I mean, they grew all sorts of things. They grew tomatoes, various kinds of green beans, pumpkins, various kinds of things, and they also, the little farms also had their livestock, and they would load the livestock in trucks and haul them to the Indianapolis stockyards. Indianapolis had a stockyard at that point, and get paid for their livestock, and then they would go to the county's, the sale barn was in Franklin at the county seat, and the farmers would go to the sale every Saturday and either buy or sell livestock or buy or sell equipment. It was a big event. Everybody converged on the county seat. The women would do their shopping, and Franklin would just fill up with people on Saturday. And Life magazine did a piece in a pictorial review of Saturday night in a small town. And that was Franklin, Indiana. And they had in 1939, and they have pictures of the crowds crowding the sidewalks of Franklin, Indiana. Everybody coming into the county seat to shop or trade cattle or do whatever. Things were very much different back then. These were real farm communities back then.
There is an elegiac town tone to the book. Do you miss that era? I mean, are there parts of it that you wish we could bring back?
No, I don't think so. There were parts of it that were not so good. I mean, you didn't have penicillin. People died a lot earlier than they do today. And you didn't have the luxuries. A lot of people had outdoor toilets. You didn't even have bathrooms. And, you know, it was a much more primitive time than today. And I don't, you know, you can get nostalgic about it, but it wasn't all that great, really, in terms of creature comforts. It had certain psychological values, but we're much better off today.
Now, you said, obviously, you made the transition from Butler to several newspapers, landed at the Wall Street Journal in Chicago, and then sort of in the typical journalistic success story, we call it working your way through the chairs. you got to do it to get to where you were going, became a foreign correspondent, then wanted to come back. And you said you always wanted to write editorials. What was it about writing editorials that appealed to you so much?
Oh, just making yourself heard. Having a nice large megaphone to express your views. I wrote editorials at Butler, and I enjoyed that. We had a lot of fun with our editorials. And we had an editorial about they had to cut down a big willow tree on the campus to make room for the pharmacy building. And we ran a big campaign against cutting down the willow tree, which was just nonsense, of course, but we had a lot of fun with it. So it was something that I really liked doing.
What sort of, in the interest of full disclosure, I spent some time as an editorial writer, too, for the Indianapolis News here. And one of the things I discovered is that you really need to have a broad range of knowledge because you could be called upon to write about anything at any time. But there are certain kinds of editorials that you like more than others. What areas did you most like writing about as an editorial writer?
Well, I liked writing about economics. It has always fascinated me as to how people make their livings, what kind of people start businesses, take risks, what kind of people become CEOs. So I liked economics.
And you see it. Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to pick this up on the other side because your definition of what economics is in the book is also is also fascinating. We are talking with retired Wall Street Journal editor, columnist, foreign correspondent, just about everything at one point or another with the Wall Street Journal. He's also an author, the author of a new book, When the New Deal Came to Town, A Snapshot of a Place and Time with Lessons for Today, George Malone. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimitswfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking with George Malone. He is retired Wall Street Journal editor, columnist, foreign correspondent, and he's also the author of a new book that will come out on Tuesday, When the New Deal Came to Town, A Snapshot of a Place and Time with Lessons for Today. It's a memoir about growing up in Whiteland, Indiana. Well, in some ways, it's more than a memoir because it's also an economic, political, some degree, historic and historical analysis as well, and a revision, really, of the way we look at the Great Depression. See, before we went to the break, you said that you liked writing about economics, and one of the things that, and again, I'm not giving anything away or taking anything, discouraging people from actually going out and reading the book, but at the beginning, you talk about how you view economics, and it's really not so much numbers or cash or anything like that. It is?
Well, it's people getting up and going to work every day. That's what makes an economy. It's not made by politicians or economists. It's people who actually go out and produce something or create something or start a business or invent something. The economy is an organic thing, and the government can help it in many ways, but the government can also do a great deal of harm to an economy, partly by unnecessary regulation, all kinds of things, and partly by government intervention into the market system. Market system works very well. It makes the adjustment between supply and demand through the mechanism of prices. And if you mess around with prices, you're going to get trouble. And that's what the government very often tries to do, to try to benefit some particular lobby group. And that's what happened during the Depression. They were trying to benefit the farmers, give them some help, and it worked out very badly.
Gotten a question from a regular listener named Gary via Facebook, and if you would like to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what Gary has done on Facebook and find us at No Limits WFYI. Gary wants to know about Brexit, its likely impact on the United States. And he's got another question about, whether we should worry about the possibility of another world war. But why don't we start with Brexit and its impact on the U.S. economy, if any?
Yeah, I was against Brexit myself because I was writing a lot about the putting together of the European Union. And it was a historic achievement. These countries that had been warring with each other for centuries managed to get themselves together and form a economic union and partly somewhat political union. And I know why Brexit occurred, because Brussels tried to accrue too much power and started making regulations, and the British finally got tired of it, so they said, we want out. They're not out yet, of course, and we don't know what's going to happen, but, there may be, it's not quite certain what will happen after this, but some of my friends were for it. They basically saying, just show those guys in Brussels that we're not going to take orders from them. So, but I still think it's not good to see any kind of a breakup in that union, because it sure solved a lot of problems of the world that have gone on for centuries.
Do you worry at all? And I think, Gary, if I can, I'm going to take liberties with your World War question here. Because in some ways, Brexit is symptomatic of a lot of themes we're seeing now. And it's not just in the United States, although we're seeing it made manifest in sort of the rise of Donald Trump, where it is sort of this idea that we withdraw from the larger world and, you know, the free flow of trade and and the world economy, you know, and build walls, either, you know, in Trump's case, literal, and in the case of Brexit, to some degree, they're metaphoric. But to find ways to isolate ourselves, as you point out, you know, the European Union, in addition to being a trade arrangement and all of that, became a handy mechanism to keep people who had been fighting with each other for centuries from doing so.
Well, I don't think the chances of what we would call a world war are very great. There are chances of very dangerous situations developing. Putin is in a kind of an aggressive mood. He's trying to test us, and has done a pretty good job of it, and we haven't really responded very effectively. China is also an ambitious country. It's developed enormously, and has built its military up, and so we are in competition with China. So there are a lot of dangers in the world, as there always have been. Probably not the danger, since Europe is now pretty much unified, not the kind of danger that occurred when we had World War II, but other kinds of dangers. And I've always argued, and I think the Wall Street Journal has always argued, that the best way to avoid war was to have a strong military posture so that people will not think that you're weak. And we do have a strong military posture, but we don't want to give the impression to I dealt quite a bit with the KGB over the years, and those guys don't understand kindness. they think it's weakness. So you don't treat a guy like Putin as a nice guy. You drive a hard bargain with him, and so Trump talks a lot. I don't know what Trump would be like trying to run foreign policy. I think he would need a lot of help from some very skillful people, because he doesn't really know that much about it. But there are going to be some big problems. There's going to be some economic problems as well, and particularly the Federal Reserve has seriously distorted the credit markets, and they don't know how to get out of it. So that's going to be an ongoing problem, and so yeah, we're still living in a dangerous world, but I don't see any repeat of the kind of thing that happened in World War II.
And we've sort of alluded to the rise of Donald Trump. I'm going to pull you into your role as you know, a part of the Wall Street Journal family and all of that. The Journal has, I'm trying to think of the right verb, struggled is not quite right, but to figure out how it feels about Trump at different times. And that's not surprising, because many parts of the Republican Party, many parts of the conservative movement has struggled with that. We on this program, we talked with David Brooks, the New York Times columnist, a few weeks ago, who and his thesis basically was, there really isn't a conservative movement right now. There are only about six of us in the country who seem to be conservatives, and we're going to have to rebuild this whole thing. Where do you see conservatism right now, in this sort of one way or the other post-Trump era? Whether he wins or loses, we are moving into a new era.
Well, I think, first of all, it's very hard to define conservatism or liberalism or whatever. But I think the country is fundamentally pretty conservative. People who are trying to make a living want conservative policies in the sense that they don't want any big government experiments like we had during the New Deal, which disrupt things. And they seriously did disrupt things in the 1930s. And Obamacare, of course, was another big government program that went awry. It was supposed to reduce health costs, and of course they were going up sharply, health insurance. So I think the people are, and I think as David Brooks once wrote, it's kind of baked into our DNA that we're a capitalist country. I mean, everybody, you know, we're all in business somehow. And that capitalism isn't necessarily conservative. It's actually venturesome.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little hard to blend all these things together. But Trump was a wild card. He seemed to be he awakened a lot of discontent, resentment, and so forth, apparently among people who voted for him. And I have the feeling if he gets elected that he will probably surround himself with some fairly bright people. He has done that in the campaign. He has some good economist people I know. And he doesn't always listen to them, unfortunately. And the big beef I have with Trump and the journal has with Trump is on trade.
Mm-hmm.
We think he's absolutely crazy on his protectionist ideas. That's what we did in the 1930s. We shut down world trade and we had a big depression. And I don't think he's going to get by with it. I don't think he can do that. I don't think Congress will let him do it. But that's a very scary thing.
Now, you've got another book coming out next year, right?
Yes.
And can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's a book about it's a history of Wall Street Journal opinion, going all the way back to Charles Dow, of Dow Jones, who not only invented the Dow Jones Index, but also started writing general editorials very late in life, rather than just market stuff. And Charles Dow, in 1902, wrote editorials about the anthracite miners' strike. And interestingly enough, for a guy writing for Wall Street, he was very even-handed in his approach to that strike. He argued in favor of collective bargaining, and he kind of invented the concept, which the journal still has today, of free people, free markets. And that has lasted down through the years for 114 years. And that's pretty much where we've been all these years. Times change, various opinions come and go, but the journal has always favored democratic representative government and free markets. So we have a big problem with Trump on that. I think that if he gets elected, he won't be able to do some of the things he claims he wants to do. He'll find that it's a very different world out there from the one that he's imagining.
Where did you come up with the idea of doing a history of the Wall Street Journal opinion? Is it something the Journal wanted to do?
It was one of my colleagues. I had written some things. I wrote a history of our page for the 100th anniversary of the Wall Street Journal. And I'm sorry, 75th. And that was kind of fun. And one of my colleagues said, why don't you turn that into a book? So I said, well, yeah, okay, I've already written some of it. That's what I did. And mainly I'm just quoting the editors and writers over the years and the positions that we took.
We are talking with retired Wall Street Journal editor and columnist George Malone. Jennifer, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi there. Thank you. I was just curious. My grandmother, who grew up in Kingman, Indiana, on a farm, she talked about they never knew that they were poor because they always had food. And she also talked about the men that would stop by, hobos, who would, you know, ask to be fed. And her parents always fed them. But my grandpa, who grew up in Indiana in a town, said he remembered being, you know, getting whippings for stealing corn and watermelon. I was just curious if there were, you know, what's the difference was there a difference in charity between farm towns and cities on, you know, people who were hungry and trying to get food?
Try to get you an answer, Jennifer. Thanks very much for the call and the question.
Okay, thank you.
Certainly.
Yes, I don't know whether there was much difference, but it is true that there was an old tradition among farmers of taking people in, because back in the days before motels, when people traveled by horse or horse and wagon or whatever, they had to stop somewhere for the night, and very almost invariably they would stop at a farm and say, "Can you take me in for the night?" And the farmer would always say yes. When we had a farm, that's what we did, and that's what everybody did. And so there was that tradition, and that carried over to the Depression when people were traveling around as hobos, and we fed them.
So the book comes out on Tuesday, right?
Yes.
And you're here, obviously, because there are some events running up to the publication. Are you planning to be here through the publication day on Tuesday, or?
No, I'm heading back east tomorrow.
Okay, well, so people can find it, though, at almost any bookstore, Barnes & Noble, and on Amazon.
Absolutely. And, on Amazon, of course. Yeah.
So I'd like to thank my guest, George Malone. It's been a fascinating conversation. I've enjoyed talking with you.
Well, thank you very much, John.
Certainly, and thank you to our listeners. I'd like to welcome you all back on Tuesday when we're going to be talking politics, I hope for the last time for a little while, because it's Election Day. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood, and board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Cherzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations. We'll be right back.